This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
This podcast is sponsored by IQ Bar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQ Bar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ Bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.
The podcast from True Anime is... I think it's really cool, and that is what I wanted to say.
Two and a mic. Two, 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 two and a mic. Two, 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 two. This is my first podcast with my brother Greg. We are still hoping that our third sibling, or the chosen one, as you would believe him to be should you witness the extraordinary attentions visited upon him by our mother, will at some point join us in discussion. Hope dies last, or so they say. Today we have decided to start with a book review of Robert Fabry's wonderful Vespasian series. We will not only apply ourselves to books, but rather to all things that shaped us growing up, individually and collectively. With my brothers, we will record our diverse recollections of the past, what events remain stamped on our memories, and what manner of silliness we would sincerely hope our offspring will somehow avoid repeating. Hope dies last, or so they say. What is to be expected from these exchanges is a squirt of sobriety and a generous helping of laughter at one another as much as with. It has always been our way.
Greg, man, it's great to have you on. Just in case people don't know, you're my older brother. Congratulations.
Thank you. It's the weirdest thing to be congratulated with, but great.
Yeah, but it's also, I think, the first time that somebody has congratulated you for being my older brother. And coming from me, it must be significant.
Yeah, yeah. If I heard it from someone else, it'd be even stranger, I suppose.
Not unless they didn't know me. If they knew me, they would have congratulated you for your patience and your suffering longevity. Anyway, how's it going in the world of Blighty?
Yeah, not bad. I guess most of the news nowadays isn't set here, but we all know that. Yeah, the agenda's certainly moved on. But yeah, everything's well, thank you. And you?
Yeah. Well, I can't compare. We're a bit closer to the hot zone, I guess. I presume by which you're referring to Ukraine, but
yes.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, we'll just see how things play out, really. But yeah, I mean, we actually have got together to talk about something that it's like a passion that you and I have shared, even though our youngest sibling hasn't necessarily taken on the mantle.
No. Did you bring his replacement with you?
I was about to, but then because we struggled with our that connection here, I decided not to run off and get it. Next time, though, I promise.
Okay.
Next time it will be here. I'm sure he'll be delighted for the, not quite necessarily the best substitute, but something.
the sweep doll.
Well, there you go. So we both have a passion for books. Do you remember the first kind of books that you chucked down at me?
I remember we both used to read the ridiculous fighting fantasy books when I was too lazy to read anything else.
Yeah,
it's almost embarrassing now to think about it, but they were fun in their way, I suppose. But you could get through an entire book and having read only about 7 pages worth of text.
Well worth the investment, I think. But I really enjoyed the Lone Wolf books, which I mean have since been turned into these play your own adventure or make your own decisions. But I think when I read them, they were actually just normal books. But Steve Jackson, was it, or Ian
Livingston and Ian Steve Livingston, Jackson were the two main writers I remember. I'm sure there are others, but those are the two that stick to mind.
I mean, they continued, didn't they, for a long time, and they had about like 60 odd books, I think, in their series.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm sure we gave up well before they came to the end of their careers. But yeah, well, we read a few. I know that we had quite a few of their books hanging around.
Yeah.
But actually, it was you that got me back into reading after after many years where I just had put down books.
What was it?
I can't remember. I can't remember whether it was historical fiction or whether it was.
It wasn't Wheel of Time, was it?
Could it have been Wheel of Time? Were we reading that back when?
Well, this was in the 90s. Yeah, I mean, I picked it up in 98. Wheel of Time.
Oh, no, it was something else then, because no, it was before then. I was probably about 19 or 20 when you thrust a book in my hand and said, "Here, read this. It's really good." And okay. I did, and I got the bug back, which had evaded me for a number of years. I was just off enjoying myself doing other things. Hadn't even thought about reading.
It's weird, isn't it? Because you got me into reading in the first place. Do you remember? I used to love, I think, I can't remember how many times I read Step by Piers Anthony. I thought that was fantastic.
Oh, that was a great book. I love that book. Yeah. Did I give that to you or did you pass that to me?
No. I think I got that from you. Okay. I don't know what happened to the book, by the way, but I recently purchased another one because it was just such a fascinating read, I remember. And then there was also one, he wrote a series, like, again, sci-fi. And the first book was Vicinity Cluster. Do you remember that?
Oh, well, I do remember it. I can't remember reading it, but I must have done.
Yeah, no, I'm sure you did. And I have a feeling you also had the second book in the series, but I can't remember it. But these are just books that, you know, just brilliant, really good books.
They were good for sci-fi back in those days. They were very, very good books. Of course, my memory now is such that I could barely remember the things I read last week, which
which bodes well for today's chat, clearly.
Indeed, yes. Yeah. You better get on with it quick.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've got any recollection at all.
Yeah, true. That's fair enough. So, all right, because this is your choice, yeah, because my choice is going to be completely different. But, this is your choice. Do you want to introduce it?
Yes, well, thank you. I chose Robert Fabry's Vespasian series. So, obviously, we decided to start with the first one, which is called Tribune of Rome. And I read this book a number of years ago, just shortly after it was written, I think. And I came across it, and I enjoy my historical fiction, as you know. So I picked it up, and I just really liked it straight away. It's really, really, it's well written, really nicely researched, very well very well sort of put down, very accessible. Anyone can read it. We don't have to have, you saw some of these books, you need to have a PhD in history before you start. But this is really, really easy for anyone to access. But it's told in such a way that even people who like the story of Vespasian can still relate to it and get something from it, because the depth of information which is put down and the way it's expressed to you, it's very, very good.
Mm.
How did you find it?
Yeah, well, it's similar to you. I kind of have this habit of I compare books to other like similar types of books, but not necessarily in a critical manner. I say, all right, you know, would this kind of fit in with the storytelling of this individual? As in, for example, if I read a book by, let's say we've done Fabry, if I were to invite Fabry to the pub, and then I had, say, also invited Bernard Cornwell to the pub, which would be a bloody great thing to achieve.
That would be an evening.
Yeah. I mean, could you imagine? Yeah. And I think to myself, would these two guys be able to have, you know, a great conversation about some of the topics that arise in these sorts of books? And I have a feeling that they would actually really get on quite well. And I'd actually add to that a couple of other people, but we'll come back to that later on. So that's kind of my approach. But I think you're right, because, you know, he also tries to, you know, I had this feeling, I really enjoyed the book. I think it's great. And I'd love to read the other eight that are currently there in the series. But when I started, it was a bit of a slow burner to begin with. But then at a certain point, it jumps. As soon as they hit Rome, mm-hmm. the story jumps. Yeah.
I think that's a very clever device that he's used there. Because I think that was very much how things were back then. Especially for his life, he probably had a very slow life up to that point. He was brought up for a number of years by his grandmother while his parents were away. His brother obviously being away with the army, so he had that kind of slow, mundane lifestyle. He really enjoyed his time with his grandmother, and of course, he picked up certain skills while he was there, which sort of led him away almost from the military life, which he would be expected to partake in, but. It prepared him in a different way for so many other things. Mm. And you need to ask yourself: was that part of the reason that he was able to achieve what he did? And I think he's a fascinating person to read about, particularly because he's almost veiled at least in our learning here. Nobody writes about him. That I've seen, it's not a character. You know, everyone knows about Caesar. We'll hear about the things that Nero and Caligula got up to, but Vespasian is almost forgotten. Even though he's probably left the most lasting impact visually on all of us with the Flavian Amphitheatre, which was started by him. Of course, he passed away before it's completed, but his son completed it, and that one incredible structure is always personifies Rome. For us now.
Mm. Yeah, you talk about the Colosseum.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's the other name is the Flavian Amphitheatre, which is his surname.
Yeah, absolutely. You're trying to trick me there, but I kind of knew what you're talking about.
Sorry.
That's all right. That's fine. It's okay. I'm used to you throwing curveballs. Actually, I'm used to you throwing all kinds of balls at me, but anyway.
I'm not going to mention the Batman card that came the other way.
That's probably a good thing. To be honest, I thought you were sending me some kind of subliminal message when you suggested this book, because the two brothers hate each other. And so
I've forgotten that. That's shown only at the start of the book. And as you can see, they're warming to each other towards the end. And if you do continue with the series, as you know, I did read the first, I think it was the first six I got through. When it was initially available, I've got to read the last three now, but their relationship changes greatly over the years. But I think that's there on purpose to show. I'm sure he can't have known. I don't know that anyone out there said, yeah, by the way, the brothers hated each other. But maybe that's again a device used by the author to make their relationship more interesting.
Mm.
But it's also particularly plausible if he was a good few years older, that having been away with military service, that he would have picked on his younger brother.
Yeah.
Given that Roman society, had this, really quite kind of strict. Everyone looked up for each other to whom they were supposed to look up to, and you look down to those you're supposed to look down to. It's just the way they were.
Mm, yeah,
that comes through in this book as well.
Yeah, in many ways. Also to sort of finish off the earlier point about it being a slightly slow burner, I think there was also a bit of scene setting by Fabry, as in it wasn't enough, it seems, to simply tell a story. He also wanted people to understand exactly, as you explained there, the kind of life that people live, and also the names, as in he didn't just simply talk about the courtyard garden, he called it peristylium. And so I felt at some point I was almost being kind of educated in the architecture of Roman homes and sort of domesticity, if you know what I mean.
Absolutely, I agree with you. But it's done in such a clever, it's done in a subliminal almost manner, so you don't realize that it's being fed to you slowly. He's describing a garden and then he's calling it whatever word he wants to use for that part of a garden. He's not thrown at you in your face. It's quite subtle, and I do like that.
To confirm your point there as well, just to read a couple of lines. He nodded to the boy and headed into the main house by the side door, straight into the peristylium, the courtyard garden surrounded by a covered colonnaded walkway off which his room lay. Any hopes that he had of avoiding his mother were dashed as she appeared out of the tablinum, the reception room leading to the atrium. I mean, these kinds of terms, essentially, you do have to get to know a little bit and become acquainted to before you really have a feeling of the layout, of these sort of noble homes. And these guys aren't, by any stretch of the imagination, particularly wealthy, are they? This just considered average nobility.
Yes. No, I mean, you need to get to a certain amount of wealth before you could be invited to be a senator. I think it was a million sesterces was the was the wealth required in order to become a senator at this time. So I think, I'm not going to tell you later what happens, but his uncle obviously has that because his uncle is a senator when they arrive in Rome. So he's the obvious sort of patron for them to enable them to get to know other important figures in Rome who could forward their careers, both military and not non-military. Which is, of course, what happens with Lady Antonia. I mean, the whole thing about Canis, I don't know how much of that, whether any of that rings true in terms of whether or not. I do believe he did have a mistress. I think I read that somewhere else.
That did exist. The relationship with Canis did exist. And it went on for a long time, until she...
But she was called Canis. Okay, I wasn't. Yeah. I wasn't aware that was actually completely, completely the case.
Yeah.
Okay, that's good.
Mm. As I was going to say, as in, quite a lot of these main characters actually did exist.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure about the uncle. I mean, did the uncle exist, or was the uncle simply used as a facilitator in the story?
I think the uncle existed, but I think whether he was as colourful a character as appears in the book, I don't know. I mean, obviously, thinking back in books to come, firstly they get a lot more. How can I put this? Detailed in the nature of what sort of activities his uncle and others get up to. So the first book, this book has been relatively general and also quite gentle in its treatment of let's say depravity of the age. But that changes quite quickly because in the next book, I think it is, we would meet Tiberius, and he's on another level to anything we've met so far.
Okay,
he is quite mad.
Okay, yeah, that's interesting. I mean, there's obviously Caligula plays a role, but I have a feeling that Fabry's not going to touch on some of the things that Caligula became later famous for,
at this moment in time, Caligula is a playful and relatively carefree, slightly lustful young man who's living in a household of a very powerful lady He knows that his father was killed and he came to an end before his time. They suspect through Antonia, who may have had a hand in that. He starts to build up his character. And then, again, in books to come, you see how Caligula, or should say, his character changes. Mm. And how he begins to, he becomes fearful of his uncle. And then you can see where he begins to go a little bit mad himself.
Mm, a bit awry.
Things do go awry for him. But again, some of it is down to his circumstance. Mm. And some of it just comes down to absolute power. Mm. And what that does to people.
Yeah. I mean, I think what Fabry does in the first book, as you say, he probably takes a very gentle course. So the uncle is very much homosexual. He loves to, he has lots of slaves. My only concern in these examples and scenes is the youth of some of these slaves, because they do seem to be quite young and lithe and so on.
That's very much in keeping with the age, I'm afraid to say.
Yeah.
So if you go back to ancient Greece, it's quite open that young men, even young patrician men or young, let's say, noblemen in Greece would be expected to have a patron. And part of the patron's job would, this could be a family friend or someone who's maybe 10, 20 years older than a young lad. And part of their job would be seen to be educating them sexually, which would include taking them under their wing in ways which today would be frowned upon very much, but weren't so in those days. And similar in the Roman times, I think it's fair to say that a lot of Roman men would have had both male and female lovers, regardless of being married or those, especially with slaves. Slaves weren't considered to be being, what you did to your slaves was entirely up to you. Mm. There was no. It was very much something being lawful or unlawful, and as long as it was lawful, it was fine for you to do it. There was no question of morality in the ancient world as we would understand it today. So yeah, whatever guy, whatever Uncle Gaius did behind closed doors was his business.
Mm. I mean, I'm on a completely different book. I'm currently going through the Starbuck Chronicles by Bernard Cornwell, and it's the American Civil War, and so slavery plays a huge role in it. And I do find it horrific in general, listening to the kind of references made to slaves and so on. And this is something that obviously, it's very hard to be critical of sort of ancient times culture with such a contemporary morality. I just find it discomforting the way people treat slaves in these books, especially the younger ones. And that's the only thing, that's the only problem I have with the uncle. The story will develop as it is.
Absolutely. Yeah. But I think that's deliberately so, because otherwise it would be to mask what really occurred. I think you have to draw attention to these things. Just otherwise you don't get a complete picture of what life would have been like.
Mm. Yeah. But also on the other hand, I mean, battle scenes. You and I think we've been spoilt a bit when it comes to battle scenes written well. Because we've read the same books, I think, Robert Jordan and Brandon Sanderson were fantastic when they used sort of introduced magic in battles. But if we talk about real battles, when we talk about Bernard Cornwell's Saxon Chronicles, Con Eagledon, when he did the Julius Caesar, Valerio Massimo Manfredi, the way these people wrote about battles in their books, I just find it just fantastic. The detail, the tactics, the analysis, the characters, the placement. It's all, you're there, aren't you? You're living the scene.
Yes. Yeah, I love that too. I mean, I'm a particular fan of ancient battles. I love reading about them. It's great when you see a film that's well made and it shows an ancient battle, which you, you know, you may know about, and some of the detail that they get across in film or indeed on the written page. I do enjoy that very much.
Mm.
This one, there's not much by way of battles in this particular book. The others that come later do have more. I'd say they're more really skirmishes in this book, apart from that one main battle toward the end.
Yeah. But that tide was turned quite quickly as well, I think, by the Romans. But one particular skirmish, I think it's almost a skirmish. I mean, it's a battle, but there's one part of the battle which kind of shook me, was that the tide wasn't quite turned against the Romans, against Vespasian, but when the women attacked.
Yes, yes.
And then, you know, the way they reacted, I mean, this clearly happened, as in this was a real event, I think, because it was,
horrible. I think at the end of the book, he says, at least a copy I have, he says that the actual women in that battle didn't attack in that particular battle, but in others they did. And but he felt that he changed history a little bit for that battle, but he wanted to make it a little bit more interesting at that point. Because otherwise, as you say, the tide on that battle turned really quickly in favor of the Romans. And then to have that thrown into doubt with the women attacking when they did in the way that they did, and that really kind of gave it a new breath of life. And I think, again, he did that on purpose because he understood it. It gave much more interest. And the Roman reaction, again, as forgetting the fact that it didn't happen in this battle, the Roman reaction very much would have been what they did, which is basically to have killed everyone, regardless of, you know, who they were, age, sex.
Yeah, but as in, you know, the fact that, you know, women fought in battles, and they were treated as combatants, as in
absolutely,
as in just to read just a couple of lines. And Vespasian butchered his way forward without pity, killing young, old, beautiful, and haggard. It made no difference to him. He was full of hatred and cold fury. This was not the frenzied elation of battle. This was the awakening of the deep desire that men keep within themselves to see people not of their tribe or creed die.
Hmm.
Yeah. And we're talking here about Roman legionaries have surrounded a group of women who fought against them. And they basically mow them down.
Yes. Yes. And you know, there's many examples of when, I think generally with Rome, it was considered, you could misbehave once as a client, and they would slap you down and forgive you. But the second time you can expect no quarter. Yeah. And the greatest example of that, I suspect, is probably what they did to Carthage, where, I think the term was they turned the soil with salt, which means it could never be used again. So Rome generally, if you got out of line once, okay, you know, you're in trouble. You know, they're taking the heads of the people in charge, maybe, but put new people in place. But a second time, you can expect to be dealt with very harshly. And they dealt harshly with their own, as again we see in this book. They have a particular punishment for when in a legion doesn't do the job it's supposed to, or if it falls into any kind of disarray, they take a tenth.
Yeah, and it's the soldier next to him that has to do the job.
Yes, well, I mean, there are different. I think there are different types of punishment meted. Another one I've read of is, so every 10th soldier is picked, and then the nine surrounding him, then the nine to either to his left or right, would be then given clubs, and they would club him to death.
Unbelievable. Yeah, I mean, this is so hard for us to contemplate, but unbelievable.
It was called decimation, and meted out in any part of the army which was seen to have not performed.
Yeah. But then after that, I suppose the legion would also be disbanded, wouldn't it? I mean, if it is decimated, and then after that, were they also not on occasion disbanded?
On occasion, yes, but not necessarily. That would be meted out in order to save the legion, I'd have thought, usually. Because then if that didn't work, then they would have to probably, you know, go further. But that would be telling. No, it wouldn't necessarily be a legion. It might just be, you know, it might be a century whatever part of the legion it was, it would be done specifically to punish them, to show them that they have done wrong. I think there have been times when it's done to a legion. I think if they were contemplating or tried to mutiny of some sort, and then a legion would be, you know, would have to have that meted out on it. As you can imagine, you know, the thing is that these guys are fighting in very serious situations, and the only thing that keeps the Roman army working and beating much greater numbers who are, you know, armed with what look like on the face of it far deadlier weapons is their discipline.
Mm.
And without their discipline, they're nothing. And you know, and the, you can read it in the description of the way the fight takes place. It is the Roman war machine. It is these guys next to each other with their shields closely placed next to one another, making it really difficult for these you know, javelin or scythe like blades to penetrate. And yet they're able to push forward with these short stubby swords, but ultra sharp and gutting the man in front of them. Like it's literally like a meat grinder.
Mm. Yeah, because you can't swing a broadsword or an axe at close quarters, at least the way that they fought. So
yep. They make it, and so their discipline becomes the thing that keeps them alive.
Yeah. Now, it's interesting also because the tactic of a shield wall is also taken on in sort of later periods, isn't yes. it? And these yep. these are the Saxons and so on, and they develop yep. them further.
Vikings, yep. they have different sorts of tactics. I think with the Vikings and the Saxons, I think their shields firstly are much smaller and round. The Viking shield you'd classically read about. So they would form a shield wall, but they would also be very much much prepared for one-on-one combat within a less structured battle. Mm. I think from what I've read of Viking battles, but yeah, I guess times were different as well.
They clearly didn't have the wealth and advancement that Rome had. So no. Yeah, different. Well, times. I
mean, interestingly. From Roman times, the next time that an army marched with surgeons was Napoleon. So in between those times, the, you know, the Romans had a military surgeon or doctor to look after the wounded, and Napoleon brought it back. And in between those times, nobody bothered.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah. Very curious. Okay. I mean, if looking at it though, as well, Roman times, I mean, it's so often overlooked. Okay, we're talking 2,000 years ago, but I mean, thinking about some of the characters in the sort of ancient Rome, there is this unbelievable wealth of just stories to tell of. You know, I can't think of another empire that had so many, you know, amazing people for one reason or another, for, as you could in some way say, good or bad, depending on whether or not you believe in the existence of those words. But I mean, Vespasian, Caesar, Nero, Caligula, Seneca, Cato, Suetonius, Antonia, God knows how many more. These are fantastic characters and all worthy of books in their own right.
They really are. Well, I mean, the great introduction to this family, I'd say family, obviously Vespasian is not part of the same family, but at least going down as far as Nero, is Suetonius's 12 Caesars, which was remade into I, Claudius in the UK in the 1970s.
Mm.
And I would love to see that remade today. Mm. I can barely remember it because I was very young then, but I remember it being on television in the late 70s. And it was really, really interesting and a great introduction into the Junior Claudius family.
I mean, the thing is that also, you know, the more you kind of read about ancient civilizations, the more you realize that in many ways they were so much more open-minded and so much more modern than we are. in many ways. You could all, as you said before, I mean, if it wasn't illegal, then fair play. There was simply no judgment to the extent that there is now. People pretty much, I mean, this concept of existentialism, where you essentially do what you believe you wish to do, your desire is to do, and you kind of maximize your ability to do it. The Romans did. They lived that way. They wanted something, they did it.
Yes. Yeah, they really did. And up until the point where it offended somebody higher up than you in the food chain. At that point, that's when you've sort of done something wrong. So obviously the highest, you know, the greatest of that being the emperor. There's some great stories about what various emperors did to senators. So the senators went from being the all powerful in the days of a late republic, where they were the ones that everybody looked up to, and of course to be consul was the highest accolade you could achieve. But you could only hold the position for a year, and then there'd be another vote the year after, meaning that you wouldn't get out of line too badly normally, because then you knew that someone could take you down the year after. And I think this is what a lot of senators at the time of Nero were seeing to be the problem with empire, was once you take away that balance or that check to absolute power, and he sees, or a single person sees, that not only is if something is immoral, oh, sorry, if something is not illegal, the morality does not come into it, and therefore you can do what you like. But when you put that into the hands of one man who has nobody above him, you basically make him godlike in the eyes of others, and particularly himself. And he can do no wrong. And whatever he does, whatever he wills, should be. And that's, you know, we've seen that's very dangerous. Mm. And we're seeing that today, actually. You know, how what's happening further east of you. Mm. A man has set himself up where he has absolute power, and nobody can talk him down. He has taken care of the two things which really matter, which he has his own Praetorian Guard around him, and beyond that, the loyalty of the army, at least for now. And everything's locked down as far as he's concerned. He can do what he wants.
Mm.
But it's not really that far removed for us to see, is it?
No, absolutely not. And I would actually hazard to state that there are two people east of us who have set themselves up for this. The only distinction being that one is a member of NATO and the other one isn't. They both are above any kind of constitutional limitation to their power. Greg. Brilliant. I mean, thank you for choosing this book, because, you know, I loved reading Con Eagleton's story of Julius Caesar, and this kind of threw me back into that a bit. And I am intrigued and sort of looking forward now to continuing the story of Vespasianus. But the next book, it's my turn to choose, and I'm going to bring us, sort of throw us into the future, if you don't mind.
Okay.
Yeah. But do you want me to let you know now, or?
It's up to you. Do you want me to do that on air? It's your prerogative.
Yeah, it's just, it's, the book is written by Piers Brown. I don't know if you're...
I thought you'd say Brosnan there.
Yeah, well, I don't know. He's not bad as well, I guess. But and part one is called Red Rising.
Okay. Yeah. I hope you're going to email this to me later. Not.
I am.
Discuss my memory.
I am indeed. Don't worry about it. Yeah. So Red Rising by Piers Brown. I think you're going to like it, actually, because also there is a direct sort of connection between this, even though it's a sort of fictional science fiction set in the future. But there are lots of references to ancient times. So I think you're going to enjoy that. But a great choice, Greg. And thank you also, because it's nice to, you know, to just talk books, really. Okay, we didn't only limit it to talking books, but what could we do? But it was great. Thank you for your time, Greg.
Thank you. This is my first ever podcast, so thank you for making it easy for me.
Well, what can I do?
Or at least not too difficult.
Yeah, all right. I mean, it's the chat, really, isn't it? I mean, yeah. Between us. But yeah, no, I've thoroughly enjoyed it. And yeah, I look forward to being joined by either our younger sibling or a suitable substitute.
I okay, that's great. Either way, hopefully it will be our brother. Otherwise, bring the squeaky dog.
Take care, Greg.
Oh, take care. Bye bye.
Two and a mic.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.